Hub
and Spoke Audio Collective.
We can have the future we want, but we have to work for it.
You're listening to Soonish. I'm Wade Rausch. There's an alluring idea that we keep falling for over and over here in America. It's that there's a magical way to solve all of our social and economic problems. And it's to take the disruptive thinking that supposedly accounts for the spectacular rise of the software and computing industries and put it to work in other fields. Take an industry like energy. Obviously, our century-long dependence on fossil fuels has come back to bite us in the form of massive climate disruption. So back in the 2000s, we saw the rise of this whole field called clean tech, where the goal was to take ideas from software and networking and rework the energy infrastructure to achieve new levels of efficiency. Then there's healthcare, which is also pretty broken, thanks to a system of employer-provided private insurance that dates back to World War II. That system creates a stack of warped incentives where doctors and hospitals only get paid when people get sick. And then once people do get sick, they feel like they deserve the best available care, no matter what the price tag. So costs keep rising out of control. As an antidote to that, we now have the field of health tech, or digital health, where the promise is that data-driven decision-making will keep patients healthier and bring costs under control. In finance, there's fintech. In restaurants and delivery, there's food tech. And in education, we have edtech, which is the sector we're going to focus on today. The thing is, none of these tech movements have truly transformed their native industries. At least not yet. Don't get me wrong, it's not a totally dumb idea to ask whether you could take ideas from software and the internet and the mobile revolution and use them to bust out of some of the inefficient patterns that old industries run on. But frankly, it is a dumb idea to think that the very specific conditions that enabled and powered the tech boom in Silicon Valley over the last 30 years can be recreated in any other industry. And it's even dumber to think that you could revolutionize whole fields of human endeavor, like education, simply by throwing software at them. At the risk of giving away the message of this episode at the very beginning, here's what I'd say about fields like clean tech, health tech, fintech, and especially edtech. Changing an industry to make it work better for everyone is a lot harder than just adding the suffix tech. For one thing, these fields aren't blank slates, the way the personal computing industry was prior to the 1980s and 90s. They've each got infrastructure and practices and ruling theories that go back decades or centuries.
First of all, I just want to give you an example of edtech that is about 100 years old, almost 80 years old, which you may not realize, but which helped the United States in World War II. And I'm going to tell you the technology. It's augmented reality.
This is Sanjay Sarma. He works at MIT, where his title is Vice President of Open Learning. And he oversees the part of the institute that develops massive online open courses, or MOOCs.
And you might say, what? Augmented reality has been used for 80 to 100 years? Where is that? Well, let me tell you where. During World War II, before World War II, America was able to train pilots much more effectively than to Japan. Both countries could produce planes. That comes down to flight simulators, which is a technology that America had. And it is, in fact, truly augmented reality. And in the initial flight simulators, the Link company, were very mechanical, and over time they became computerized. But there is a technology that transformed an industry.
Sarma is absolutely right that flight simulators changed the way we produce pilots. The founder of the Link company, Ed Link, came from a family in Binghamton, New York, that built player pianos and pipe organs. Ed loved planes, but he couldn't afford flying lessons. So in the late 1920s and early 1930s, he adapted the electric pumps and bellows mechanisms from the organs to build a kind of toy plane. It was mounted on a universal joint, and it had controls that let the pilot steer through the three axes of pitch, roll, and yaw, just like a real plane. This trainer cockpit was connected to an external desk, where an instructor could speak to the pilot over headphones, like a ground controller. The Army Air Corps started using the Link trainers in the mid-30s. And by the time World War II came along, tens of thousands of U.S. and Allied pilots were using the Link trainer to learn how to fly.
You are given a particular set of courses and altitudes to fly, and you get simulated wind and weather conditions.
In the blind link trainer, listening in his phones to the instructor's directions, he acquires the personal skill that will one day enable him to fly 600 miles over a darkened Europe to Germany.
And when you have theoretically come in for a landing and touched down under minimum visibility conditions, believe me, you feel like it was for real too.
After the war, British Air Marshal Robert Lecky said, quote, "The Luftwaffe met its Waterloo on all the training fields of the free world where there was a battery of Link trainers," unquote. But how's the Link trainer an example of EdTech? Well, in Sanjay Sarma's eyes, the most important thing about the Link machine wasn't the mechanism, but the way it looped in the instructor. Instead of teaching flying from a book or in front of a blackboard, instructors could coach pilots through the literal link from the desk to the cockpit.
It would be too expensive to train pilots in the air, right? So instead, we give them a lot of training on the ground, and then the coaching, the mentoring, sort of a form of flipped classroom, is where your pilot professor, if you will, the expert, teaches you to become like Sully, and you know, so that when you can land the plane in an emergency and be an excellent pilot.
Sarma thinks that one of the lessons of the current EdTech hype cycle is that technology like MOOCs can never completely take the place of one-to-one coaching and feedback from a human coach or professor. In fact, that's one of the themes of a book that Sarma and his co-author, Luke Yoquinto, published last year called GRASP, The Science Transforming How We Learn. It might seem strange to hear that the person who coordinates online learning programs at MIT thinks that MOOCs have their limits. But the real point of Sarma and Yoquinto's book is that we need to rethink the entire education process, from kindergarten through grad school, to open it up to more people, to reflect the latest science about how people learn, and to make sure we're automating the right parts of the process. That's why I wanted to talk with Sarma about the book, because by the time this pandemic is over, and students and teachers can start meeting together in actual classrooms, we're going to have a lot of new evidence about which parts of the learning process require in-person interaction, and which parts can and maybe should be delivered digitally. And that might get us to a place where we can better articulate what K-12 schools, and especially colleges and universities, are really good for, and what they should look like in the future. Sanjay Sarma, welcome to Soonish.
Such a pleasure to be here, Wade.
So we're here to talk about the book you published last year with science writer Luke Yoquinto. It's called GRASP, The Science Transforming How We Learn. And the book makes the case that our systems of K-12 education and higher education pretty much all over the world have one component that is fundamentally flawed. And here's where I wanted to start. You call that component the winnower. So can you first explain what you mean by the winnower and where the winnower came from?
Yeah, it's very interesting, right? I mean, if you are a parent and you have three kids, do you pick winners and losers and say, okay, this kid is meant for great things, or do you want to make them all successes? The education system as we have it today, it conflates education with selection. So you say, well, of these 30 kids, this kid gets an A and that kid, you know, isn't going to make it. And we came to that, I think, through a collection of circumstances, because we conflate, as I said, education with selection. And the result is that we have lost sight to some extent of the transformative duty of education and a commitment we should make to take every learner and make them successful, rather than simply saying, okay, these four made it because they got good grades. So it's a pretty fundamental thing. And I think it's the tail that's wagging the dog of education right now. Obviously, in the end, someone's going to make a hard choice. You know, does this person get the job or not, right? Does this person write better software or not? Is this person a better singer or not? I mean, that happens. But I think that has seeped too deep into our establishment, where rather than taking accountability and saying, I will transform you, young lady, young man, young person, to become the most successful person you can be, it has become a bit of an excuse to sort of almost say, I'll move on. So that's a challenge.
One of your main arguments in the book is that the way we've designed education over the past maybe 200 years makes learning far too difficult, which may in fact be a deliberate part of the design, since if learning is too difficult, that kind of ensures that a lot of people will fail and get winnowed out. So maybe that's the point. But you argue for a quote-unquote cognitive reckoning a phrase I really love, that will make the act of learning much more user-friendly. And so I'd like to ask you a little about what you have in mind.
Yeah, so Luke, who's been a tremendous partner in this, very talented and collaborative friend in creating this, you know, we were sort of tossing around how to capture this really a hairball of ideas. And that concept of learning becoming an obstacle course to see who finishes rather than an escalator, which lifts everyone, right, to their capability. And that trade-off became very clear to us. And the problem with the obstacle course is that in some ways it absolves the learning community of the responsibility of transforming all. As I said, I keep saying, compare this to parenting. Imagine if parents acted this way. We don't. We cannot. So that trade-off became very, very clear and also tragic. And this is something we need to rethink, because in the new world, this winnowing won't work anymore, you know? And people are going to demand more because the economics of education are changing, the job market is changing, the challenges are becoming bigger. We have to empower, enable, and transform all learners at all ages.
Okay. So the way I read the book, there's one driving question throughout, and that's how the science of the brain meets up with the art of teaching and how we can take what neuroscience and cognitive science are discovering about the way people actually learn and the way memory works and use that to reinvent education. And hopefully do it in a way that doesn't winnow out so many people based on arbitrary things like, I don't know, their place of origin or their family income or their test scores. Is that a fair way to summarize the book?
I'd say so, yeah. I mean, what I would add is that we don't think it's merely cognitive science. We think that there's an inside-out element, which is how do the neurons work, how do the the brain work. And there's an outside-in element, which is recognizing that the brain is extremely complex. We may understand the neuron, but it's extremely complex. And the emergent properties of the brain, the emerging behavior of the brain, is hard to predict. And so we need to sort of, on the one hand, understand the mechanisms, but also cater to the whole brain and to the whole person and their needs and their interests and their motivations and their emotions. But in doing so, to your point, make sure that we create a successful individual.
At a high level, what are we learning about how the brain works, either from the inside out or from the outside in, that should change the way we think about learning and teaching?
It's very interesting. We're learning inside out how memories form, the importance of forgetting in memories, and all sorts of tricks like spaced retrieval, which is you shouldn't learn in one chunk. You should be doing things over, you know, weeks and months, and then you learn it better, interleaving, mixing things up. But outside in, we're learning the importance of curiosity. We're learning the importance of context. And we're learning the importance of coaching, which is where people can contribute.
I want to break in here and explain a little more about what Sarma is saying about how memories form. For example, we know from decades of cognitive science research that we learn new material better when we space out study sessions by days or weeks, rather than, for example, trying to cram for an exam the night before. The technique is called spaced retrieval or spaced repetition. Interleaving is directly related to that. If you use the gaps between your study sessions for topic A to turn to topic B instead, it turns out that you learn both topics better. And the idea behind context is that it's really hard to absorb the essence or the practical meaning of what you're learning until you have a chance to apply it in a real-world situation. The paradox is that the format for most classroom education today still works against all those insights.
And if you actually look at the full picture, our education system is backwards. And what I mean by that is in-person time should be dedicated to context, curiosity, coaching, you know, things like that, right? Teamwork, peer activity, connecting the dots, looking at the big picture. But we squander it in one-way lectures. And the one-way lectures are better done online, not using Zoom, which is actually the worst way to do it, actually. But using asynchronous videos and things like that, right? Where the student can watch them in their own time. And it's called the flipped classroom. And the classroom is where you do all the stuff that we should be doing in person. So that's what we're learning.
Sarma says a lot of his thinking about how learning should work is informed by his own experiences as a university student in India, and then in his first job as an engineer at Schlumberger, a big global company that provides services to oil drillers.
I grew up in India, in a really terrific school, great professors, but in a traditional system. It was very hard to get into the school. There's a competitive exam. And you know, tens of thousands of people took the exam and only a few hundred literally got into it. And I got in and then I got lost. And I was talking to one of my classmates the other day, and he remembered that I was the fun-loving student, not the student who aced everything. And then I went from there to work directly. I didn't go to grad school. And suddenly I rediscovered myself, because I suddenly discovered the importance of context. I discovered the importance of actually doing stuff with what you learned, as opposed to putting it in escrow and hoping that it might come useful someday.
You do talk in the book about how you learned mechanical engineering in a theoretical way in college, but it wasn't really until you started a job on an actual oil rig in the North Sea, having to actually monitor and repair these giant drilling machines, that you had a hands-on, practical, everyday, very urgent reason to understand these concepts in practice. And that's when things started clicking for you.
Without a doubt. Look, context creates the shelves and the drawers to put your information in.
In the 1990s, Sarmat joined MIT as a professor in the Department of Mechanical Engineering. And pretty soon, he got a chance to put his insights about context to work as the co-instructor of a course in design and manufacturing called 2007. It's also known as MIT's famous robot competition.
It's a very MIT course where students get a kit and they're asked to build robots, and then there's a competition. It's so outside in. You know, you're not teaching, you know, how to design a gear, which is what we learn in India, or how to, you know, calculate the stress. We do that in other courses, but in this course, it was about systems thinking. It was thinking outside in, designing, you know, strategy. And I realized, oh my God, that provides all the context in a class that I got when I went to work. And that to me was sort of transformative. That's outside in.
In 2007, students have a different challenge each year. All of the competitors start with the same box of parts. And the point is to come up with their own unique solution to the engineering challenge. Like one year, there was a Star Wars theme, and the main object was to spin a pair of wheels attached to the engines of a Model X-Wing.
All right, are you guys ready?
Yeah!
The judge is ready. At 3, 2, 1, go! Lights up.
Oh, Tom's
got a good
launch.
Always start a little late, but very reliable.
Cleared the ladder.
Both
Ooh,
reach
locked in.
The lower level thruster.
Oh! Catch me!
We have a 5, 4,
all right.
3.
Let's see how Richard
2,
can come back.
1, time, manual. See if you can recover from that.
All right, we've got 36 seconds left.
So he's going to add 313.
Richard is not going down without a fight. He's getting all the points he can. It's 520 to 635. 24 seconds left. Cantina band has deployed.
Wow.
Can he get any more points? 14 seconds left. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Time's up!
That's it! Tom is our winner!
I'll be shouting. This is amazing.
Way to go, Tom! Our 2017 007 champion. Sanjay, I think you know what time it is.
But context, you go, oh my God, yep, that's where this control theory is useful. Or that's where mechanics is useful. That's where heat transfer is useful. Oh, that's, you know, those are the ways in which a gear can wear. Or these are the ways in which a pressure vessel can leak and explode potentially, right? That context is so fundamental. If we flipped the way we learned, we taught, and focused on context and curiosity, our outcomes would be, you know, significantly better. And students would have a much better time of it. And we'd have more citizens who are willing to take on the problems of the world that we're leaving them with.
We'll work our way back around to the 2007 robot competition in a minute. But first, I wanted to ask Sarma about MIT's contribution to a different kind of education. That's sort of the opposite of hands-on engineering training. Namely, massive online open courses. In 2011, MIT stood up a whole program to produce new MOOCs called MITx. And together with Harvard, it formed a nonprofit called edX that's now the world's second largest provider of MOOCs. Since 2012, you've held, as far as I can tell, at least three different titles at MIT. You were Director of Digital Learning, then you were Dean of Digital Learning, and you're currently Vice President of Open Learning. And I suspect that there's a bigger story behind the way your title has evolved, and that it may reflect the way MIT itself thinks about these opportunities and its obligations in this area of education reform. So can you tell that story?
Yeah, you know, when so I wasn't involved in inventing the massive open online courses. That was the president of MIT and someone who I think deserves a lot of credit here at MIT, Anant Agarwal, who became the edX, CEO of edX. The two of them developed the MIT version of the MOOC, and then working with Harvard, established edX, and then Anant left to lead edX. And so the then chancellor, Eric Grimson, requested me to take on that role. Initially, we were trying to figure out how to make MOOCs. And then as we got into it, we realized, my God, if you're going to make MOOCs, massive open online courses, first of all, we've got to take advantage of this other incredible legacy MIT has, which is OpenCourseWare, which was founded 20 years ago. So we combined those two. And then we realized we need the rules for doing this. What is the science of learning? We can't do this on instinct. And so we established the MIT Integrated Learning Initiative to look at the science of learning, which contributed in part to this book. We have eminent cognitive neuroscientists here. People like John Gabrielli, who've been thinking about this for decades and have made tremendous contributions to learning and learning-related conditions like dyslexia. And then once we did that, we realized that we needed to also launch a worldwide lab for people to access or get, you know, access to this content. So we launched the Jameel World Education Lab. So it kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. You know, we started doing more and more and more. And it became more and more central to MIT. For example, we launched a stackable credential called the MicroMasters, which has now taken off. There are more than 50 on four continents, and we launched it here. And so as it became more sort of fundamental, but also as the scale grew, I mean, we have almost a million people enrolled in our MicroMasters at various levels of the MicroMasters, more than 4 million people taking our MOOCs. edX has crossed 100 million enrollments. So the role grew, and that is what led to both the change of my title, but also the fact that the president wanted this role to report to him because he felt it was very critical to the future. And it worked out during COVID. I mean, obviously a terrible time for humanity, but the skill of being able to do stuff online has served MIT and other schools in good stead.
But Sarma says that just because MOOCs turned out to be useful during the pandemic doesn't mean educators have worked out all the kinks. Are there examples of edtech that are working in your mind? And then conversely, are there other examples of edtech that may be not working? Maybe edtech turns out to be actively counterproductive in some situations.
Yeah, edtech is the tool, and it can be good or it can be bad. So to me, massive open online courses, stackable credentials, and a lot of the cognitive tricks that are used in, for example, online language programs, whether it's Duolingo or Babbel. By the way, all of them, many of them use the tricks that I write about in my book, right? That's the strange thing. Most professors don't know them, but these software programs do, right? It's, I think that's where I point to success. Having said that, this is also going to be a fad. There's going to be a lot of talk about how suddenly, oh, I have an AI program to teach your kid to ace, you know, math. Be a little bit skeptical. There's going to be a lot of confusing and mediocre stuff out there. But there is no doubt that if you take the Khan Academies of the world, you take the 3 Blue 1 Brown, which is a channel on YouTube, or ViHot, or Minute Physics, or Crash Course, they are wonderful. And the content is out there, and it is transformative.
You do also give examples in the book of school districts that are perhaps so understaffed and overstretched that they wind up calling on some of this online courseware as their whole curriculum, basically, and they stick students in front of their laptops and tell them to progress through these courses, but without any in-person sort of expert handholding and instruction, as if the content itself were enough. That seems to be a recipe for failure. And yet it's kind of a temptation, if the content's out there, to deploy it without marrying it up with adequate in-person instruction, right?
Absolutely. Look, this is a tool, and the tool can be abused. In fact, that's what I was referring to. You can stick kids in front of it and assume they're going to learn, and or adults for that matter. Actually, adults are better. There's more volition. There's more discipline. But to stick a kid in front of it and declare victory is a terribly sad, hollow use of the technology. And that's what I caution against. The fact of the matter is it's a tool, but it's a tool for the human. The learner is a human and the coach is a human. You can make the coach much more effective. It's a force multiplier, but it multiplies. And if you multiply zero, you get zero. And that's the problem.
So speaking of coaching, the example of innovation in education that you come back to the most frequently in the book, it kind of animates the book in a way, is again, course 2007, the robotics competition at MIT, which does in fact seem to embody all of the stuff you're talking about in terms of hands-on learning. To quote Woody Flowers, I think, he talked about not just learning calculus, but how to think using calculus. And the robotics competition is all about how not just to build a robot, but how to think through engineering, right?
Look, first of all, 2007 was created by someone many of us at MIT, particularly me, consider a hero in education, Woody Flowers, whom you mentioned, who passed away as we were writing the book. It was really heartbreaking. And this book we dedicated it in major part to his memory. The thing about 2007 is this recognition that we can take a kit and give it to students and give them a competition, you know. And the competition is they build one robot each, or maybe a robot and a helper robot. And we don't particularly encourage, but they can interfere with each other and they get scores. And every year it's a different competition. And the final day is stunning. It's a stunning competition. What it embodies is this ability to take an open-ended problem, break it down, think through the issues strategically. Now, most schools would shy away from it. You know why? Because it's hard to grade. It's hard to find coaches. And remember, most schools say, we will only teach something if we can grade it. And that is a reflection of this winnowing mentality that warps our view of learning and education.
So they solved that at MIT by making sure that the winners of the competition don't get a huge advantage. I mean, your success in the competition is not a big part of your final grade in 2007, right?
Yeah, so we decouple winning the competition. That's a different recognition from the grade you get in the competition. The grade is based on how you, to your point, thought about design. You know, are you thinking in the right way? Are you thinking about mechanics in the right way? Are you thinking about friction in the right way? Are you thinking about the actual design, the components, the way you laid them out, your winnowing of design ideas, not of the of the students, right? That is what we judge, and that's what the grade is based on. That decoupling is wonderful.
But the conundrum that you yourself acknowledge many times in the book is that 2007 is a super expensive course. It may be, in fact, the single most expensive course per student at all of MIT, and so, therefore, the most difficult to scale up. Although I guess that there is a living example in the form of the first robotics competition for high school students. And it's a huge success. So many kids compete every year. But are there other ways to think about scaling up some of those lessons about the value of winnowing out design ideas and the importance of having a human coach there to work with you through this whole process of building an effective robot? How can you scale that up to millions of people?
I absolutely believe we could scale it up, without a doubt. It does take a lot of effort to think it through. It'll take some money to actually put that effort in. But it doesn't have to be 10 times more expensive or even twice as expensive as school is today. I just feel that we need to change our systems. For one thing, if you had a lot of online content, you would create time for the teachers to be coaches rather than simply repeating in the classroom what they could have done online, right? So right there, you created resources. And that content is almost there already. I mean, you know, the government doesn't have to spend a lot of money. Just go to YouTube and search these channels. You see amazing content. Khan Academy by itself has transformed, has produced a lot of content. And the coaching can be very broad. I mean, for example, you know, look, think back to, a few hundred years ago. Did Michelangelo ever attend a lecture, right? And he turned out pretty good, don't you think? I mean, Leonardo turned out pretty well because they were coached. I mean, you could read Vasari's book about the Renaissance sculptors and painters, and you can see that they worked in apprenticeship, right? So I think that there is actually a range of things we can do. And in fact, I have another book coming out shortly, which looks at everything from apprenticeship models to internship models to certificate programs where you actually work with industry all the way to vocational schools. So I don't want to go on and on, but look, to me, what happens with FIRST Robotics is a classical example of taking this expensive MIT course and scaling it, getting the parents involved, getting clubs involved, and you can flip it. But this deserves the attention of the national government. This is a Manhattan Project for the good, you know? We need to do this. Maybe the better analogy is this is the moonshot for our future generations.
Hopefully someone's listening in Washington. I'd like to read a passage from the book where you're talking about what is it that creates the perceived value of a degree from an elite school like MIT. So here's the quote. "There's a truism whispered among administrators at top colleges and universities concerning why students keep signing up for elite schools. The value, the thinking goes, comes in three parts: the stuff you learn, the people you meet, and the fact that you got in," unquote. Full disclosure, I should say, as somebody who went to Harvard for college and MIT for grad school, I'm guilty as charged. But the question is, how can you change the whole winnowing process without first changing what it is that people seem to value about elite educations? It feels like elite gatekeeping institutions like MIT are seen as elite because they're small and selective. And so I'm wondering, you know, with MITx, with edX, with open learning, do you see yourself as trying to work against that framework or work within it somehow?
Yeah, I mean, I will say that the school you went to, Wade, MIT, we value not just the selection, but the people you meet doesn't include just each other, but also includes the professors and the grad students. It means that our students can apprentice with these research programs. So I would say that the second, I wouldn't write it off. I think it's important. You create a community of excellence and people grow on that excellence. The third, the way we address the third issue, which is the selection, right, which is the you got in, so you must be good, is with through programs like the MicroMasters that we invented at MIT, that we now, the edX has deployed, and there are more than 25 universities on four continents implementing. And well, here's what we do. The MicroMasters, it's say half of a master's, but it's fully online. You don't get a master's. You get this new credential we invented. We call it the MicroMasters. But get this, wait, there is no admissions. Anyone can take it. So right there's no selection, right? We call it inverted admissions. So that's why we have almost 1 million people enrolled. And then they take the courses and there's exams and there's a final exam. It's all sort of proctored. And if you finish, you can apply for the actual master's, but you can finish in half the time. And we have more than 120, 130 universities around the world that will admit students. Now, what did we just do here? This is not selection based on a piece of paper. This is achievement. So we believe that you can actually invert the funnel or take away sort of a paper-based admissions and make it one of proving you can do it to yourself as much as anyone else.
There's still a winnowing process. It's just that the students are winnowing themselves in a sense, and it's based purely on how hard they're willing to work.
Yeah, it's not me. Yes, exactly. It's entirely based on that. And so it's a trade-off between those two worlds, right? And we put a lot of effort into making the content sort of well-produced, and we use all the cognitive tricks. It's not as if we're making it cognitively unfriendly and seeing if you lose interest. Oh, see, we got you. You lost interest, and so you're not good enough. As opposed to that, we make the videos short, and we produce the content right, and we apply, you know, all the stuff I talk about in the book. So we take that away. The other thing that's happened is once we did the MicroMasters, a bunch of other universities came to us and said, look, you'll probably admit, you know, the top of the top students, but we'd like to admit, you know, students in our continent because it'll be more convenient for them. So we said, so we thought about it, and we have more than 100, actually almost 140 partner universities now, literally on five continents, that students can apply to with their MicroMasters and go there, which is less expensive. They can top it off. But they're doing it based on their achievement and their sort of intent. They're displaying that.
Do you see signs that the MicroMasters credential will begin to take on some brand recognition and some meaning in the ladder of achievement?
I do think, and I know, that the MicroMasters and other credentials like this are gathering value. I get calls all the time, you know, people I know who say, hey, my son got a MicroMasters, and now they're getting a job there, and it's serving them well. Their boss loves it, you know? So yeah, without a doubt.
I wrapped up my interview with Sarma by coming back around to the question of what the pandemic is teaching us about edtech. Is remote learning, at best, a poor substitute for in-person teaching? Or is there still room for new technologies that could bring hands-on education and coaching to many more people? The way the Link Trainer helped thousands of Army Air Corps pilots learn how to fly. Has the pandemic revealed unexpected strengths or unexpected weaknesses in our practices around education and technology and distance learning?
Absolutely. In fact, I wrote an article about it a few months ago. In some ways, the pandemic is the worst of both worlds. Let me explain. In a lot of classrooms around the world, education was distance education to begin with. What do I mean by that? You know, the professor would talk, the students sitting, you know, 10 rows back, tuned out. And at least there was some human touch. At least the student could talk to their neighbor or, you know, maybe approach a teaching assistant or ask the professor something, should they have the stomach and the interest to do that, right? Pandemic, we just took that and put it online. We're in Zoom world. It is neither good online education, which would be asynchronous, very carefully crafted videos like we do in our massive open online courses or we do in our MicroMasters or that what Sal Khan does on a Khan Academy. It's not that, nor is it in-person sort of done right or even in-person done not right, but with some human touch. It is the worst of both worlds. And a lot of people are calling it online education. I please beg you to understand that is not online education. That is a heroic attempt by well-meaning teachers, well-intentioned students, and suffering parents to make good in tough times. It is not good online education. So it became very clear to us that we needed to sort of flesh out our vocabulary. But I think the science bears itself out. If you want to make Zoom lectures more interesting, shoot a video on your iPhone, send it to the students and make the Zoom a discussion. That's called a flipped classroom, right? So a lot of these things, yeah, I mean, my God, if I could, we could write a whole new book now.
Okay, well, the book, once again, is called GRASP, The Science Transforming How We Learn. It came out in 2020, but you're still kind of doing the virtual book tour. So I want to thank you for joining me, and thanks for all the work you do, Sanjay. This has been a real delight.
It's such a pleasure, Wade, and look forward to meeting you in person someday.
Soonish is written and produced by me, Wade Rausch. Our intro music is by Graham Gordon Ramsey. The outro music and all the other music you heard in this episode is from Title Card Music and Sound in Boston. You can follow the show on Twitter at Soonish Podcast. On our website, soonishpodcast.org, there's a transcript for this episode, as well as the full show notes, including a link to Sanjay and Luke's book, and some great videos from MIT's 2007 robot competition. Soonish is an independent podcast supported in part by you, our listeners. Your donations on Patreon help me stay independent and keep making more episodes for everyone to enjoy. A reminder, all Patreon supporters of Soonish get access to one of our coolest rewards, tomorrow's episode today. That means access to every new episode of Soonish one day before everyone else hears it. It's like living in the future. If you'd like to support the show, please go to patreon.com/soonish. And thanks. Soonish is one of 10 independent podcasts that have banded together to form the Hub and Spoke audio collective. And this week, I want to tell you about a sharktastic episode of The Briny from producer Matt Frassica. It's about how long-distance ocean swimmers deal with their fear of things from below.
They said it was important to stay in shallow water because great whites are ambush predators, meaning they approach their prey from below. When I went back in the water in the weeks after the attack, every time I put my head under, my heart started racing. I imagined seeing something coming up from the darkness. And two words kept repeating in my head. Ambush predator. Ambush predator.
The episode is called Fear is the Thing with Fins. And one thing I love about it is that Matt not only produced the show, but wrote all of his own music. You can find that episode and more at thebriny.net. And you can always check out the rest of the Hub and Spoke shows at hubspokeaudio.org. That's it for this episode. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back with a new episode
soonish.